It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Do you remember the first time you felt the call of the road?
I was at Colby College, which is one of these Ivy-covered liberal arts schools.
Long-haul trucker Finn Murphy.
My parents and I were walking down this leafy walkway. Somebody's playing guitar under a tree, and there's a couple kids throwing frisbee. And I said, I'm not coming back here. I'm going to sign up with North American Van Lines, and I'm going to become a driver. My father, who had never gone to college, and that was the one thing he didn't accomplish in his life, he said, you've done 3 years here, just one more year. Why don't you just come back and finish? And I said, because I'm afraid it's going to finish me off first. When we got home, he actually gave me a bill for 3 years' tuition, which he expected me to pay back. I looked at it, and I was shocked. I couldn't believe that he was doing this. And I flung it back at him, and I cursed at him. And he looked at me, and he said, don't use that language in my house. And I said, I'm not going to use anything in your house. And I picked up my duffel bag, walked out of the house, and went down the street to where my truck was parked. It was to be my first day as a truck driver. And my parents and I didn't speak for 2 years.
Everybody loves the road, but some people love it more than others. Finn Murphy found his career and his calling on America's highways. He's the author of The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. And the first thing he told Steve Paulson is that he's not just any driver with a big rig. He's a long-haul mover, or as truckers say, a bedbugger.
We've got bedbuggers, those are the movers. You've got the live animal haulers, those are the chicken chokers. You've got the flatbedders, those are the skateboarders. You've got the hazardous material people, those are the suicide jockeys. Yeah, so everybody's got a nickname.
And when you say you move people or you move families, I mean, what you're saying is you load all of their stuff. You load their lives into the back of your truck.
Yes, and we pack their lives. I mean, the moves I do now, people don't lift a finger. A more or less typical example, I had one few months ago. A man was moving to Vancouver from Connecticut. We walked in, my crew of seven movers and myself. He finished his coffee. He loaded his family into the limousine. They took off for the airport, and we washed the dishes, stripped the beds, packed every single carton, loaded the truck, put his car in the truck. And then at the other end, we unpacked everything, put his dishes back in the brake front, made his beds. This is full service move. These things cost, $70,000, $80,000.
I'll say full service. My God, you even washed the dishes.
Sure, why not?
What about life on the road? Do you like that?
Well, it's more comfortable now than it used to be. The trucks are better. I've got a nice brand new sleeper in the back. I've got a Sealy Posturepedic mattress. I've got 600 count sheets in the sleeper. I've got a feather duvet, and I've got a microwave oven, a refrigerator, a desk. It's actually very nice.
You do not sleep in motels, in other words. I mean, you sleep in your truck.
Most of the time. If I sleep in a motel if I have to spend a few days or something like that, but there's no reason to. My truck is cleaner than most motels, and it's certainly cheaper. And my mini bar has Gatorade in it, and it's not $8. So, yes, I sleep in the truck.
So I'm curious about what life on the road looks like from the trucker's perspective. I mean, any of us who have driven cars on a highway, with their trucks whizzing by us. And I guess I'm wondering, is there anything we should know about what you do or about, what trucks are like, as we're driving by? I mean, what don't we see in your life or in your rig?
Well, let's start with what we do see, because we see everything that people do in their cars.
You're checking us out.
Absolutely everything. Yeah. So if you've driven by a truck driving a car and you've been in the passenger seat, have you noticed you look up at the truck, at the driver,
right,
and then he looks back at you? So that happens every time. It's some kind of telepathy thing. I don't know how that happens, but I know when somebody's looking at me.
And do you like that? I mean, is that meaningful at all, that moment of eye contact?
It can be. It depends on what people are doing. Sometimes you have the kids doing the arm thing so that you hit the air horn. Sometimes you just have somebody look up and then you get this, you could see they're sort of wistfully looking over and wondering, like your question is, well, you know, what kind of life is that up there with that guy? So that's nice. I guess what I was saying about we can see everything what people do in their cars is most people are usually doing something else in addition to driving. You want to know what the main events are that people do in their cars? People are eating. People are spilling liquids.
Really? It happens that often?
Oh, yeah. It's not just you, Steve. No, they're disciplining the kids in the backseat. They're texting and putting on makeup. But here's the number one activity for American drivers is they are working on their relationship with the person in the passenger seat. And you can tell that from the body language, from the index fingers, from the shrugs. There's a lot of romances being worked out here. Mostly it looks like there's some conflict. Every once in a while you get to see a romantic moment that's not in conflict, which is very pleasant but also very rare.
It sounds like you are kind of writing the novel in your mind. You know, what's going on in that car as you drive by?
Yeah, that's correct. I am. And I'm also writing the novel when I'm going through communities and towns and start thinking about what's changed in terms of community character, what's changed in terms of what's going on in America.
Does the country look different now? Has America changed?
So there is the denuding or the hollowing out of downtowns all over the country. You might think that it's just happened to your town or Joe Smith might think it only happened to his town. But this has happened in, you know, 15,000 towns around the United States. The core districts are denuded of locally owned stores, and then all the new commercial development is in the big boxes on the outskirts. I don't think that's good for community character. I don't think that's good for sense of place. I don't think it's good for middle-class jobs that were there that are no longer there. That's one big change that I've seen for sure. And then another big change is how the heartland, the Midwest, the you know, from, say, St. Louis to San Bernardino. I mean, there's nothing in the middle of the country anymore. It's a corn monoculture and there's no towns at all.
And I mean, that was not the case when you were first driving?
No. So this was in 1980. It had begun. Mm-hmm. But no, that wasn't the case. There was all sorts of, you know, vibrant towns along U.S. Route 6 goes from Cape Cod to San Francisco. U.S. Route 50 goes through Kansas, Garden City, Kansas, places like that. You know, these used to be very vibrant small communities, and there was one after another after another after another, and it's all gone. I don't know where it went. I don't know how it went that way, but it's done.
Hmm. So is this a beautiful country to you or not? I mean, from what you're saying, maybe it's less beautiful than it used to be.
Well, it depends on the day, Steve. So I do have a passage in there where I got really sort of dark and cynical. I think I said something to the effect of, if you wanted to do a tourist poster of the United States, instead of doing a Vermont church with a white spire, why don't we do the real thing, which is a convenience store with a Subway franchise inside and an underpaid immigrant mopping the floor, and outside somebody's holding a piece of cardboard saying anything helps. That's true. And it's not all the truth, the entire truth, but that is part of the truth. And yes, is it beautiful? In many, many, many places it is. As I said, you know, I think the New Jersey Turnpike is beautiful. I also think the Rocky Mountains are beautiful. I don't think replacing every truck stop restaurant with a Subway franchise is particularly beautiful.
You also say that there are moments that are just total adrenaline rushes, like driving into New York City. You have a great passage in your book where you describe what this is like going into New York City. Could you read that?
I would love to read that. So here we go.
Okay.
Coming into Metro New York from points west or south has always supercharged me, but doing it in a big truck is pure adrenaline. This is the closest I've ever come to feeling the true essence of life on the road. I've got a hard, muscled body, a big, comfortable new tractor hauling a 53-foot moving trailer, grooving with my killer sound system, a 30-ounce Dr. Cola in the holder. Then there's the whistle of the supercharger as I shift into 13th gear, the whoosh of the air dryer, my mouth slightly sour, arms shaking from the pounding of the wheel, making money, setting my own schedule, the Manhattan skyline on my right, flying fast and furious on my way up to home plate in Connecticut. Me and the monster truck are hurtling through 16 lanes of the most intense, dangerous, and exhilarating piece of roadway ever devised by man. And I'm the king of it all, with my truck, my tunes, and my big independence. All the stories, the longings, the dreams, the books, the movies, the songs, the great American dream of chucking it all and hitting the road. Well, right at this moment, I am the song.
That is fantastic.
Thank you.
Kerouac in a truck.
But I have more focus. I'm actually going somewhere. And I'm actually paying my own bills.
Finn Murphy's book is called The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. He was talking with Steve Paulson. We're talking about road trips this hour. And I confess, I don't especially love or even much like driving. I do take it for granted that I can. But imagine living in a country where women aren't allowed to drive.
It was Thursday. There was blue sky. We're in the parking lot where I took the driver's seat. When I turned the engine on, I had this rush of adrenaline, and I felt like a bird coming out of a cage. I had sweaty hands, and I fixed like my hijab because I was thinking if the religious police stopped me, I have to look as decent as I could. It was the first time I drove it in the city where women cannot drive. It was really liberating. Just a simple act of starting your car and driving. That day I said, let's just drive and pass by the landmarks in the city. Make sure that when we videotape, we take shots of the street's name just to make a statement that women can go behind the wheel and drive. We posted that video on YouTube that night. The next day, it was trending worldwide. I wanted to get arrested. So I asked my brother, can I drive again? This time your car, and I want to pass by a police car. We passed by a police car. I was pulled over. Someone called the religious police. That's when things went really nasty.
Manal al-Sharif on the drive that changed her life. We'll find out how after this. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. I grew up assuming that as a woman in America, I can do pretty much anything a man does. Get an education, a job, own a house, drive a car. But Manal Al-Sharif grew up in Saudi Arabia, where women have had to fight for those privileges. And she did. She got a degree in computer science. She became one of the first women to work in IT at Aramco, the national oil company. And then, on her 32nd birthday, she did something that would seem so harmless here. She drove a car in public. That turned her into the leading voice of the Women to Drive movement, and it also put her life at risk. Well, last month, Saudi Arabia finally made it legal for women to drive, so this seems like a good time to revisit our conversation about her memoir, Daring to Drive. It's the story of how she was imprisoned and charged with driving while female.
What I violated was not a law, it was a custom. And even if there was a law, I would challenge that law because it's unjust. The same night after I was released at 2 a.m., the secret police showed up at my doorstep. I was taken for interrogation and then I was strip searched. And they put me in jail, women jail.
And how long did you stay there?
I was there for 9 days.
When you were arrested, what was the public reaction?
The newspaper didn't do me well, really. They pictured me as evil, as Asian to the West, as someone who wants to corrupt the women, as unholy. One clerk went so far to call for my lashing in public.
Manal, I think it's important for women here to understand just how physically restricted life is for women in Saudi Arabia, how much less freedom they have just to move about, to go places, even, for instance, to leave the house.
Imagine you live in a city, big city like Los Angeles, and you don't have a car, you don't have public transportation, and you don't have taxi companies that are reliable. And at the same time, you cannot walk in the city. Now you need to go to your job or your school or just simple act of going and buying your grocery. These are our cities. So we're forced to hire men to drive our own cars and they live with us in our homes. So we have to bring non-Saudis to drive our cars. They don't speak our language. They don't even know how to drive a car. We have to teach them.
So women can own cars, but they just can't drive them?
Yes, my car is under my name. I bought my car, I paid for it, but I couldn't drive it. And I had a driver's license from New Hampshire.
This shadow transportation system you described, what I don't understand is you said this is a system of mostly foreign taxi drivers who in many cases are illiterate or don't know the rules of the road. And these are the men that women hire to drive them places. And yet, most of the time, in every other aspect of life, women are never allowed to be alone with men in Saudi Arabia, strange men, except in this one instance.
This is the contradiction. We have the gender apartheid in my country, where men and women are never allowed to mix. So growing up, men and women, we studied in different schools, different colleges. My male professors, I've never met them. I've always seen them through CCTV. The families themselves are segregated, where my cousins, my own cousins, when I reach puberty, I cannot talk to them. I cannot mix with them.
You can't talk to your male relatives?
No. If I meet them today in the street, I wouldn't even recognize my cousins. But the right to drive in my country is, we use it as a symbol of civil disobedience to protest the guardianship system. That the law does not recognize me as an adult. All my life, I'm a minor. I'm considered a minor before the law. And we use the driving as a symbol of civil disobedience.
You should explain the guardianship laws. A woman is considered a minor her entire life, so you always have to have a guardian. At first, it's your father, but then that changes through your life?
I imagine having a car with a registration paper. And when you sell the car, the registration paper move to the new owner. This is exactly Saudi women. We have the guardianship, assigned legal guardian, male guardian. And this assigned male guardian changed through our life. If I'm single, it's my father. If I don't have a father, it could be my uncle or my brother. When I get married, it moves to my husband. Let's say I don't have a husband or a brother or a father. It can be my own adult son. My own adult son give me permission and the consent to get my papers or leave the country. Or even if I'm in jail, when I was in jail, I needed my guardian to sign the release papers. So even if I finish my sentence in jail, I'm not allowed to leave jail as a society woman without my assigned male guardian come to jail and sign the papers. And I know a lot of girls are still in jail because their family feel ashamed. They won't go and sign the papers of their release, even after they finish their sentence.
Well, in some ways, what you're describing is a culture in which women are always in jail in some way or another. I think you wrote in the book that, is a woman supposed to have her guardian's permission to leave the house?
Yes, the spoken permission. She has to ask the guardian his permission to leave the house.
So would you do that when you were married? Would you ask your husband if you could leave the house?
Yes, I had to.
What would happen if you left without his permission?
He would get angry.
I can see that the driving would become a symbol of being able to determine your own location, I guess, your own
destiny. We call it drive your own destiny.
It wasn't always this way in Saudi Arabia. I mean, the country was relatively permissive until Wahhabism, this brand of much more fundamentalist interpretation of Islam, became the norm, which was back in the 70s, I think. And you're part of the whole generation of young people that were affected by that. How old were you when you were radicalized, you know, really adopted a much more fundamentalist interpretation?
I think I was 14 or 15. It was in my middle school. When I was looking for identity and I wanted to please my religious teachers, who were the most popular in the school. And some of my generation were immune, but they were very few. And the most of us were prone to radicalization, which is following strict interpretation of the Islamic texts that was imposed on us in schools, in the street, in public places, everywhere.
And you actually became more fundamentalist than your family. I mean, you went home and confiscated your brother's music cassettes. And I don't know, what else did you do?
Yeah, I caused my brother to be kicked out of the house for one day for having a singer's picture in his wallet.
When you look back at that period of your life when you were a much more devout Islamic fundamentalist, are there things that you regret?
Oh my God, a lot. I think just giving hard time to my family. We couldn't even watch TV. I would just be the policing them for not listening to music because it was haram. Being angry at dad for not going to the mosque to pray Fajr prayer, which is the dawn prayer. I regret burning my own drawings that I spent years and years and years working on in my sketchbooks. I didn't really have choice. I was thinking this is the right way to do it. I feel like I lost really beautiful times of my life, but it's not about really reminiscing and regretting the past more than what you do with today, that you never go back there. You never fall in that hole again.
And what about now? Because you've paid a pretty heavy price for driving that car. You wound up leaving Saudi Arabia and you had to leave your son behind. Do you ever feel guilty about the choices that you made?
I think he will understand, my son. He's a big boy. Sometimes we don't have the choice. There are things that choose us, and they're bigger than us. I don't think I regret, because if no one speaks up, if no one is willing to pay the price for speaking up, there's no hope. When I wrote the book, I was thinking, I'm going to give hope to women in my country. I don't want to bring them down. I want to bring them up. I want to say, listen, I'm here. I made it.
That's Manal Al-Sharif. She's the author of Daring to Drive, A Saudi Woman's Awakening. This May, Saudi Arabia announced that it would finally lift the ban on women driving, but Manal still can't go home. because at the same time, Saudi authorities began arresting women's rights activists. 14 have been arrested since May. 9 are still behind bars.
Starting route to 66 Church Street.
Have you noticed that it's getting harder to get lost? I mean, no matter where you are, you're never more than a touch screen away from one of those frosty computer voices saying, turn left here.
Head north on North Park Street.
What if we forget how to get lost? Maybe we'll have to relearn. That's why Rebecca Solnit wrote an instruction manual, a field guide to getting lost.
There's this sort of literal getting lost, oh no, I don't know where I am, it's a problem, what do I do next? But even that poses interesting questions. You know, you don't know what's going to happen next, you don't know where you are. Is it an adventure? Have you extended beyond the bounds of your own safety, your own knowledge? Is there something to be discovered? Will you become somebody else when you find out where you are? And so navigating that danger and discovery, going beyond the sort of safe and familiar and contained, it's something that interests me a lot, coming to terms with a world in which we're not lost necessarily geographically, but maybe more metaphysically, more in terms of a world full of surprises, a lost temporally. This book is written against the grain of the moment we're in, I think, which is very much about safety, familiarity, control, about having your cell phone and GPS and automatic garage door opener. Really contain your experience so that you don't find yourself beyond your own knowledge or beyond the familiar much. And I'm interested in what happens when you do get beyond. If you're really paying attention, I think, and really living your life, you turn out not to be who you thought you were. That person you're married to turns out to be somebody else, too. Your life opens up in ways you could have never planned for. The world itself changes in amazing ways.
Feel like getting lost? Rebecca Solnit. She's the author of A Field Guide to Getting Lost. And speaking of field guides, writer Lawrence Ross found an old guidebook recently that inspired him to take what he calls the blackest road trip ever. He drove 3,000 miles from L.A., where he lives, to Roanoke, Virginia. And along the way, he challenged himself to stop only at African-American-owned hotels, restaurants, and gas stations, and to use this 1957 field book as a guide.
I'm gonna buy my green cruise up and down the road.
Charles Monroe Cain was enchanted.
First, what a cool thing to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where you kind of have this idea, wow, you know, I'm going to be traveling across the country anyway. So why not turn it into something a little bit special?
So one thing extraordinary you did, of course, was you did it based on a book. Of course, a book I've never heard of. What is this green book?
Originally, it was called the Negro Motorist Green Book, and it was done by a man named Victor Green, a New York City postal worker who saw that there was a need for a travel guide for African Americans during segregation. The whole idea was that African Americans couldn't just hit the road just like anyone else, right? Up until the 1964 Civil Rights Act, any public accommodation could say, no, we don't want African Americans to eat at our restaurant or sleep at our hotels. And so what the guide was designed to do was to tell African American travelers where they could actually stay, where they could actually eat, you know, where they could get gas. And it was a really helpful guide in order to expand the world for African Americans, because travel was something that was fraught with danger, particularly when you were going through the South, but not exclusively to the South.
Well, let's go. Let's go. Let's do it. Tell me, what was the first place you visited?
The very first place I went was Hooper's gas station over in Compton, California, which was to gas up, of course, but it's one of the only African-American gas stations in Los Angeles. And if you can imagine—
You mean now, right?
Now, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, now. Yeah, if you can imagine, you know, the car, you know, capital of the world only having one black-owned gas station, it's pretty incredible.
It's amazing. So you leave Los Angeles, and I understand on your map, you head to Arizona, right?
Right. I go to Phoenix, Arizona, and one of the addresses that caught my eye was the Louis Jordan home. Now, people who understand music and everything, they know Louis Jordan is one of the pioneers in jazz and hip-hop and R&B. And so I figured, oh, okay, this is a great thing. Maybe it's the same Louis Jordan. Maybe it's somebody else, right? So I go over there, and it's a brick building kind of in the desert. It was listed in the book as a tourist home. Listeners should think of an Airbnb, you know, of 1957. Basically, what you could do is you could go to a boarding home or a private home that someone owned and rent a room because you wouldn't be able to get a hotel. So I knock on the door, and the guy comes out, and I'm just, you know, hey, tell him what I'm doing, and I'm just trying to figure out, okay, who lives here now? And he says, oh, well, this home doesn't belong to Louis Jordan anymore. This home belongs to the Nation of Islam leader, Louis Farrakhan.
Oh, interesting.
So I was like, wow. You know, you don't think – I think it was going to be like Mabel Jones. So it was incredible to find – and I found that, you know, that history and present-day kind of mix – in almost all of these homes.
I got to ask you a question. You're trying to go to only black establishments to spend your money. How'd it feel?
Oh, it was absolutely phenomenal. And yet you mentioned the fact that one of the things I was trying to do was to see how much money I could spend at black-owned businesses.
Right.
And the whole point of that is to understand that black economics has always been one of the pillars of African-American civil rights movement, being able to have a business and then using that business to help build up neighborhoods.
Sure.
And one of the things that was great was to see, in particular, all these young entrepreneurs, particularly young African-American women who were entrepreneurs who were taking risks. This one young woman decided to open up a vegan restaurant in the heart of South Dallas.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, that's a mighty long odds when you're basically competing against some of the most delicious fried chicken and soul food around in South Dallas. And you could see how people were tying it back to some heritage when it came back to, you know, African-Americans pre-going to urban areas, being farmers and being closer to the land. And it just was great to just see kind of the entrepreneurial spirit, the risk-taking, and the pride that a lot of these business owners were taking. And so I felt really happy to spend my money there.
Wow, you sound so optimistic and enthusiastic about it. It reminds me of an interview we did once with Toni Morrison, you know, the great writer Toni Morrison. And she said, you know, it's not a popular view, but she's nostalgic for pre-segregation because the black barber and the black dentist and the black store were all patronized by other blacks and there was more community. And she said she misses that time.
There's always a yin-yang with African-American community. There's always a yin-yang because on the one hand, segregation forces you because you're declared second-class citizens by the state to be in the same neighborhood. So therefore, you have to patronize your own within those blocks, that neighborhood. But we always should remember the fact that that visceral feeling of community was imposed upon us based upon the idea that we were inferior and so therefore we did not deserve the rights of everyone else.
You know, it's funny. I'm picturing you going out and doing this and you're popping up and knocking on a door. You say you felt welcomed, but I'm wondering if you felt like you were at home when you come into these barbershops and these places and these restaurants and these buildings. Did you feel at home?
Yeah. You know, I had this one experience that I just loved. There was this one experience where I popped up around 3 o'clock in Monroe, Louisiana. I walked into a barbershop pool hall and you see about a dozen African-American men. You can tell that these are working men. Yeah. And these are the type of men, you know, with grizzled hands, with broken knuckles, you know, from having done a lifetime worth of work. And, you know, one of the things I always joke about is that being African-American, that was my passport in, but it didn't mean I gained the respect. You know, I wasn't from Monroe.
Right.
They had never met me before. And they looked at me. They couldn't instantly go through the Rolodex of relatives and say, hey, you know, that's so-and-so's nephew or so on and so forth. And I looked at that pool hall as being a sacred space. You know, I stayed there for 15 minutes. It's as long as I wanted to stay there because I figured after that, my time may be running a little long. But the African-American community is a very welcoming community. You know, we always joke is that we'll teach you, you know, you come over to my house, I'll tell you where everything is one time. Then after that, it's on you. You go and you get your stuff and, you're family, you know. And by the time 15 minutes later, we'll have connections. We don't need Ancestry.com. We can make connections at some point in time of how we know each other and everything. We've never met in 50-something years. But that's kind of the warmth that you received. And I think that's life-affirming, particularly for African-Americans, because on a day-to-day basis, African-Americans deal with their regular, you know, normal lives, you know, just like everybody else. They go to work, they deal with their family and everything else like that. And then you deal with the social issues that come from the outside, the social issues intra-racial, the social issues that are interracial. And a lot of times you don't really take the time, you know, you slow down and just enjoy what it means to be part of a community that's so warm and loving. And I think this trip was one of the was something that I would encourage everyone to do.
It's funny. I not that I keep track of every word you're saying while I'm interviewing you, but I did keep track of a word that you said twice, and you used the word sacred twice in this interview.
Right.
Like, what made this sacred?
Well, I think it's sacred because African Americans in this country have always, you know, yearned for the permanence of space, this idea that I have a stake in this place. And so when we actually create something, when someone, for example, in Jackson, Mississippi, there was a restaurant called Shepherd's Cafe that it turned into called Stevens Cafe. And when I did the research, one of the things that I found was how many people talked about the ritual of going from church and heading over for a meal afterwards to go into Stevens Cafe. That's where you build your building blocks of who and what you are. Your sense of community, the sense of who you think are who are the people you think are important. And I think that's as important as walking into a church. I think that's just as important for a community as recognizing the humble person who may be waiting on you is just as royal as the mayor of the city, due to the fact that they're the person who cares for you. They're the people who recognize you, you growing up. That's what makes it sacred. You know, those are the things that, you know, it's the relationships that makes the space a sacred.
Writer Lawrence Ross talking about the Root trip, his road trip across the U.S. Charles Monroe Kane was talking with him. Our subject this hour is road trips, but some people like to go where there are no roads, to places where there's not much of anything, really.
Fridtjof Nansen, the great Norwegian, he came up with a truly radical idea, which was to build a boat that would actually pop like a cork out of the vice grip of the ice, while the team rode the polar ice pack drift across the North Pole. Nansen knew that no matter how close they drifted to the North Pole, it wouldn't drift right over it. So he knew at some point that he would have to set out on skis and reach the pole. They had the terrible luck that at the moment when they headed north, the ice beneath their feet was actually floating south. A terrible discovery, just devastating. They got quite a bit farther north than anybody had ever been, and then just said, that's it, we've got to turn around. They basically dug a hut out of the tundra and lay there in their sleeping bags for 8 months. They got a little bit blasé about the kayaks. The kayaks had cut loose and drifted away. So Nansen stripped off most of his clothes, dived into the frozen water, and without succumbing to hypothermia, got back to shore and saved the kayaks. They ended up feeding the dogs to each other until there were none left. When they got too weak to haul, they had to put them out of their misery. They got to Franz Josef Land, and Nansen says that he heard what he thought was the sound of a dog barking. And they went out and looked, and they saw this distant figure walking toward them. And you must be thinking, who the hell is this? And they sort of shake hands formally, and he says, aren't you Nansen? And Nansen says, yes, I'm Nansen. He says, then I'm very glad to see you. That was the only proof that Nansen was alive. I'm the first proof. Those guys were capable of cutting off from the real world for 3 years. They had some psychological pluck that we've completely lost. No explorer has it today.
Coming up, explorer David Roberts on why he and others risk their lives for adventure. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. David Roberts has spent his life chasing epic adventures. For years, he climbed some of Alaska's biggest mountains, and he made a whole bunch of first ascents. Later, he became one of America's best-known adventure writers. He wrote a bunch of classic mountaineering books. And his latest, Limits of the Known, is a kind of summing up, an examination of why some climbers feel compelled to push the edge of what's possible. It's also a reflection on facing death, which is all the more poignant because Roberts, who is now in his mid-70s, has stage 4 throat cancer. He told Steve Paulson, there's no thrill quite like venturing into the unknown.
And this is what motivated me when I first started climbing in Alaska, the drive to find a place that nobody had ever been, to find out what lay on the other side of a mountain, to push beyond the limits of the known.
You did that for years, right?
Yes.
In some of the most remote ranges of Alaska. You had a teaching job during a lot of that time, but you say that climbing was what mattered most of all in your life.
Yeah, I went on 13 expeditions to Alaskan mountains, all of which were unclimbed or unclimbed by the routes we tried them. And in fact, at one point, we actually were able to be the first to explore and name a whole mountain range, the Revelation Range in Alaska. That's an experience nobody will ever have again.
There was one time when one of your expeditions, you were off for 52 days, totally cut off from the outside world. I mean, this is before the days of GPS and satellite phones and all of that.
Uh-huh. One thing I do is I ask people, how long have you ever gone without contact with the outside world? No radio, no phone, no mail, no internet. It's rare when somebody will say 3 days. So I did proudly say, well, I did it for 52 days once in Alaska, and it felt wonderful. But then I think of Nansen, and I think, well, what's that compared to 3 years?
And, of course, the other side of this is that if you get into serious trouble, no one is going to come and rescue you.
Yeah, I think part of why that felt so good was that by cutting ourselves off, no radio, before sat phones, we became totally reliant on ourselves if we got in trouble. That actually, in the long run, ends up giving you a wonderful psychological boon because you don't have those worries about, well, will they come and save me? You know, it's, will we save ourselves?
So why did you do this? I mean, obviously you were doing things that were incredibly risky. You were putting your life at risk.
Well, the whole book is an attempt to answer that explanation. In particular, you have to reckon with the idea that adventure is pretty selfish. It doesn't, for the most part, do other people much good. You can't simply weigh your own feelings. Do the joys outweigh the sorrows? I think you have to take into consideration the people who are waiting at home and who will be devastated if you don't come back. It took me, believe it or not, took me about 25 years to see that.
You were just so obsessed with wanting to do this yourself.
Yeah.
That came before how anyone else was going to deal with your possible death.
Yeah, and I started climbing long before I got married, and yet I married young at 24. After I married Sharon, I realized that she worried about me every time I went off, and that actually undercut that wonderful self-sufficient, self-reliant feeling I had, because then I would worry about her worrying about me.
So Why did you do that? Why take those risks?
Well, you know, I think most adventurers are misfits in society. I felt like a real nerd and loner through junior high and high school. I went to Harvard, but I hated school. I was a math major, and I hated math. And the one great thing was the Mountaineering Club, which was the most ambitious college climbing club in the country at the time. So I basically majored in mountaineering at Harvard and ignored everything else.
You still haven't really answered the question.
No, I'm ducking it.
You are ducking it, yeah. Is there no answer? You either feel compelled or you don't?
We climbers, we adventurers, really did want to escape the rat race, the petty pace from day to day, and get away from it all and get to a place where things really mattered, where the decisions you made had a huge impact and consequences.
So the danger is a big part of why you do it.
Yeah, you can't, you know, some climbers have said it would still be glorious if there were no danger. That's just nonsense. If there were no danger, it would just be a game. Hmm.
Now, we should say that you have also experienced tragedy. Early on, one of your Alaska expeditions on Mount Huntington, one of your friends fell and died.
Yeah, that was in some ways the best climb of our lives. It was the best climb of our lives up to then, certainly. We made the first descent of the west face of Mount Huntington in Alaska, which was, we'd like to think, was the hardest climb that had been done by that date, 1965, in Alaska. And it took 30-some days before we finally broke through all the obstacles and got to the summit. And then just less than 12 hours later, we were descending, Ed Burns and I. The other two guys stayed up in the higher camp, starting to get close to dark around midnight. And we set up a rappel, and something happened. Ed rappelled first, and the whole thing came loose. And he simply fell right in front of my eyes without a word, disappeared into the void, and I was alone. Never did figure out exactly what happened. And then I had to somehow get without a rope down to the next camp, where I waited 2.5 days for the other two guys to come. It was the most intense, extreme, and upsetting experience of my life.
I can't imagine those 2.5 days, just being alone with that.
Yeah.
How did you deal with that whole experience?
I think I'm still dealing with it. I think I actually got a kind of PTSD from it, though nobody called it PTSD back then. But it also spurred me to write, and in fact, I had such an urge to tell the story of our expedition beyond just the journal articles we wrote up that the next spring I decided I should write a book about it. I'd never even tried to write a book, but, you know, I was under such a cathartic drive that I did write The Mountain of My Fear in 9 days.
You read a whole book in 9 days? Wow.
Yeah.
Talk about compulsion.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe dealing with Ed's death, I presume, was a big part of that.
Well, it's the only book I've ever written under that kind of cathartic momentum.
Did you feel guilty at all about what happened to your friend?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Especially because Ed was the youngest member, the one least committed to climbing. And what really brought home the guilt is that I went a month after the expedition was over, I went back to Philadelphia to try to explain the whole thing to his parents, who were utterly devastated and who didn't have any grasp of climbing. I spent a long, horrible weekend somehow in my self-righteous 22-year-old way trying to explain why Ed died doing this glorious thing, and it just didn't make any sense to them. They tried to find out why this was part of God's plan, and I stayed in touch with them for another 15 years, and 15 years later, it was as if the grief was as sharp as it had been the week they heard that their son was gone. Yeah, that certainly brought home the guilt in a lasting way.
You're still writing about it, still talking about it.
Yeah.
Ooh. You are now in your mid-70s, and your life has taken another dramatic turn. You have stage 4 throat cancer. I assume this has dramatically changed what you're able to do physically.
Yeah, it's curtailed everything that I used to take for granted. I can barely hike 5 miles now, and I can't carry a heavy pack. And it's a terrible loss.
Well, the other thing, too, is, I mean, you've spent your life dealing with a possibility of dying. And here, death is staring you in the face. I guess I'm wondering if all those years of climbing prepared you in any way for what you're now dealing with.
You know, I wish I could say yes, but I can't. I don't think they did. That kind of facing death is so different from facing death by cancer. One of the things I've sort of railed against was this horrible metaphor of the battle against cancer. You know, Susan Sontag wrote about this brilliantly, too, in Illness as Metaphor. Every time you read the obituary of someone who died, it's always after a long and courageous banter with lung cancer or throat cancer.
Right.
It's not a battle. It doesn't matter what you want to do or what you try to do. How tough you are doesn't matter. There was nothing heroic about it.
Hmm. Are you the kind of person who ponders the big existential questions? Why are we here? Do our lives have meaning? Or what's going to happen after I die?
I'm a complete atheist, and I don't believe in life after death, and I don't believe that that kind of existential question is worth pondering. But I do very much care about why we do what we do, and does it matter, and what's the point of it all. And I think for atheists, the idea that you might leave something enduring behind, in my case, my books, has a kind of superstitious appeal. You know, once you're dead, forget it. Doesn't matter if your name's forgotten, nobody reads your books. But I can't say that. I sure hope that somebody's still reading them 50 years from now.
That's David Roberts talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Limits of the Known. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Mark Rickers, and Halima Shah. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.